What's up, everybody? How we doing? Good, good. Hey, we can't jump into this week too quick without recognizing and celebrating what happened last weekend. That across all four campuses, we had over 150 people that decided to start following Jesus and got baptized, which is incredible. Yeah. So awesome. So if you are one of those 150-plus people, your next step is to get into a group. Groups are where we grow around here, and so we'd love to help you get connected to one. You can stop by Connection Central on your way out today, and they can help you get connected if you haven't already done so, all right? We are starting a brand-new teaching series today called GOATs, and it is not about animals, all right? GOAT stands for the greatest of all time, and if you're a sports fan, you are familiar with this term because this is often used in sports discussions. The big argument that seems to always come up between Michael Jordan and LeBron James, who is the greatest of all time. Now, as a child who grew up in the 90s, I was born in the mid-80s, so I witnessed and grew up watching Jordan and all of his greatness. We just need to face the facts that LeBron is at least making it a discussion, okay? If you saw that game winner last night, my man is legit. He's at least making it a discussion, all right? When it comes to the greatest football player of all time, now before we get into that, if you're new around here, you need to know that we're a kind of church that we say tough things to each other, okay? We speak the truth in love. And I know it's very hard and unpopular to say this in the city of Indianapolis, but the greatest football player of all time, let's just face it, Tom Brady has got that thing on lockdown, okay? Don't boo me, I'm not Tom Brady. Good grief. Now, when we go to a different discussion, which is what's the greatest college basketball program of all time, Now, wait. I think we should have an unbiased, objective way to determine this, okay? So if you're talking about an unbiased, objective way to determine this, we should just go to who has the most wins. The winningest program in college basketball history, which if you didn't know, it belongs to my University of Kentucky Wildcats. Now, I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself, man. It was too easy. We're talking about this. It's just too easy. I actually was thinking about this week. I actually feel bad for my son. I feel bad for all of my children. But I feel bad for my oldest son he's 6 years old. He's really getting into sports. And he doesn't know any better. He doesn't get the whole, like, Indiana, Kentucky, all that stuff. And so he's growing up in a home where we've indoctrinated him in the way of the Wildcats. But not only that, he's got a double whammy. My dad, his grandpa, is a Patriots fan. And so it's like, he doesn't know. And so he actually went to school this entire winter wearing this outfit. Kentucky backpack, Patriots hat. Like, buddy, I'm so sorry. He has no idea that he's unintentionally picking fights in the playground. He has no clue. He's at least going to grow up with some thick skin, that's for sure. But this is not a series about sports either, all right? That's not really the focal point of the series. What we're talking about for the next 4 weeks is the concept of greatness. Okay, greatness. And now, we all have a desire within, no matter what your background looks like, no matter if you've been in church one day or 100 years, no matter what your current beliefs look like, we all can find some common ground here because we all have a desire to be significant. Or it may be better put as this, we all want to be great in some way. Okay, we're under no impression that we're going to be like LeBron or like MJ or like any of those. Like, we don't think we're going to be like world leaders or anything like that. But we all have a desire to be great in some way. And so we're going to spend the next 4 weeks talking about what does it mean to be great and how can we be great. And really, we're going to look at Jesus' words and his teaching on greatness. And he actually had a lot to say about greatness. And I think Jesus is one of the best people to go to talk about what it means to be great. Because regardless of what your spiritual beliefs are, all of us revere and respect Jesus, at least the idea of him, right? I mean, if you don't like Jesus, you probably don't like Mother Teresa. And what's wrong with you? Like, this is like a normal thing. He's a good guy. We should all like Jesus, right? And so, and Jesus, by the way, lived 2,000 years ago, but yet we're still talking about him. His ministry was 2,000 years ago, yet it's still changing lives and it's still impacting people. And so if there's anyone that has something to say about what does it take to be great, Jesus is a prime candidate for it. Now, here's the problem with Jesus, though. The idea of Jesus is one that we all can get behind. Like, the idea of a good, loving person, a historical figure, we're all like, hey, yeah, Jesus, great guy. The problem with him, though, is that when you actually get into his teachings were very problematic for you and for me. His teachings confronted us with some really difficult realities that we have to face, and his teachings were always very challenging. They always demand change in our lives, and today is no different. Jesus' teaching on greatness is so countercultural and is so challenging to us, and it's going to turn our world upside down as we study this for the next 4 weeks. But I'm telling you, if we can apply his words, we can receive this teaching, I think it has the power to change our lives. And so here's in a nutshell what Jesus is going to show us today, is that there is a path that you and I take to greatness. And we've all been taking the same path to get there. It's the path that humanity has tried to take to achieve significance and value and greatness in their lives for thousands and thousands of years. But there is a nasty consequence that comes from taking this path that we all tend to take towards greatness. There's a consequence that comes with it. And so Jesus is going to show us that consequence. But then, past that, he's not going to leave us there. He's going to show us a different path, a different way to greatness, the path that he took. And it's one that I believe we can take as well. So grab a Bible or a Bible app or Google, get to Mark chapter 10. If you don't want to do the Bible, if you don't do the Bible app, if you don't want to do Google, I got a screen for you right here. I'll have all the verses on it. If you're ready, turn to your neighbor and say, "Oh, I'm ready." 42% of you are ready. It has gone up every service. I'm proud of you guys. We had some coffee this morning. Mark chapter 10 is where we're going to be. We're starting verse 35, and we're going to see a conversation that two of Jesus' closest followers, his disciples, have with him. And they come to him and they ask something. All right, so let's jump in. Mark chapter 10, verse 35, it starts off by saying this. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came over and spoke to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do us a favor." Now, I love they have no qualms in sounding selfish. Like, we know this is going to sound weird. We know you're like this great guy, but we need you to do us a solid. All right, we need a favor from you. We need something. Now, here it is. Here's the request. "What is your request?" he asked. They replied, "When you sit on your glorious throne, we want to sit in the places of honor next to you, one on your right and the other on your left." Now, pause for some context here, okay? The disciples were still under the impression, even though Jesus had told them multiple times that this isn't true, they were still under the impression that Jesus came to be a physical, earthly king, a political ruler. The disciples were still under the impression that Jesus was going to bring power and kingship back to the nation of Israel, that Jesus would be the king of Israel, and that he was going to overthrow the government and restore order. He was going to be an earthly king. Now, Jesus said multiple times, "My kingdom is a spiritual kingdom. I'm a spiritual leader. I'm not going to do what you think I'm going to do. That's not me." But they were hearing what they wanted to hear. And so what they're saying now is, "Jesus, when you rise to greatness, we want the seats of honor. One on your right, one on your left." In other words, we want to be your posse. We want to be your crew. Because they know that if Jesus is going to be this great, the closer they can get to greatness, the greater chance that they too will be great, that there will be some power, some fame, some influence, some prestige that will come with being close to Jesus. Really what the disciples are asking Jesus here is, "Hey, will you make us great? Will you make us great?" Now, Jesus' response is interesting. Here's what he says. He says to him, "You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink from the bitter cup of suffering that I'm about to drink? Are you able to be baptized with the baptism of suffering that I must be baptized with?" He says, "Guys, I don't think you're getting it. Following me," Jesus says, "is not going to be this path of comfort and fame and power and status. It's going to cost you something. It's going to hurt. And are you ready for that?" And now the disciples were such just typical kind of dumb average guys. They hear this. And they think, "Well, yeah, sure, this is probably just the red tape you have to cut through to get to greatness. Yeah, I'll just sign my name. I don't really know what the form is, but I'll sign it. Sure, sure." Because look at their reply. It says next, "Oh, yes," they replied, "we are able." Like, "You're ready to suffer? Oh, yeah, sure, we got that, Jesus. No problem. We're good." And then Jesus tells them a very unfortunate answer. He says, "You will indeed drink from my bitter cup and be baptized with my baptism of suffering. But I have no right to say who will sit on my right or my left. God has prepared those places for the ones he has chosen." Real double whammy for the disciples here. Not only do they not get the seats of honor, but they also get the suffering. It's like a lose-lose situation here. Now, the next verse is one of my favorites in this whole narrative. Here's what it says in verse 41. It says, "When the 10 other disciples heard what James and John had asked, they were indignant." They were ticked. Now, you know why they were ticked? Because they wanted the same thing. They wanted the same thing that James and John were going for. They wanted the seats of honor. Like, no, you can't have them. They're supposed to be mine. They wanted the power. They wanted the influence. They wanted the greatness. And you see, what I love about that verse is that it shows us that we are no different than the disciples. They're no different than us. They may have had this closeness, this proximity to Jesus, and they're written about in the Bible, and we get, but they are just like you and me. They're going down this path to achieve greatness. And it's the same path that you and I are going down. And here it is, all right. The way that we've been doing it for thousands of years is very simple. Do whatever you can to clamor for, to fight for, to strive for, to hold on to the things that the world tells us make us significant. The things that the world has shown us will make us great in the world's eyes. Hold on to them and just fight for them. And when you can get them, then just grasp onto them as tight as you can. Things like power, fame, skills, influence, intelligence, beauty, wealth, achievements, success, security. The path that we've been taking to make our lives significant and to feel valuable, to have something at the end of the day that we can hang our hats on and say, you know what, our lives were worth it, is to fight and clamor for these kinds of things. And now here's the key. We just need a few of them. We're under no impression that we can get all of them. Like, no one thinks they're going to be the most powerful or the famous or the most skillful and the most wealthy and beautiful. Like, no. We just want to get a few of them so that we can feel significant and feel great. So, for instance, we may not feel like we can be the most powerful or the most famous, but we could maybe be the most skillful and influential in our workplace. So, we could maybe get there. And so then we work 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and that justifies this kind of crazy workaholic behavior. You know, like this workaholic behavior that says, yeah, this is going to be impactful. It's going to negatively impact your family, your friendships, your relationships, your personal health, your sanity. But it's worth it because you'll get to be great. You'll get to be significant. Now, you may not feel like you can be the most intelligent person in the world. Maybe you don't have the most book smarts, but you can control your beauty a little bit. Right? You can get up in the gym, you can work on your fitness, you can buy some new clothes, you can spend a little extra time in the mirror getting ready, make sure you look good. And you know what? If you coupled that with a little bit of fame, then you put just the right filter on your social media posts and just the right caption, you're going to get some more likes and some more followers. And before you know it, you're a pretty good-looking person with a good social media account. And everything else may be awful. But at least you've got this. At least you've got something to consider yourself to be significant. I mean, wealth. Why do we spend so much time looking at our bank account? Why do we spend so much time obsessing over our 401k number? And it makes us feel some type of way. It's because we're hanging our hat on. We're saying that makes us great. That makes us significant. Why do we put so much pressure on our kids to perform and to behave a certain way? You know why? Because they're a reflection of us as parents. And if we can produce great kids that have a positive impact on society, good, fine, outstanding citizens, we can feel like we've achieved something and we were successful. We can hang our hat on it. And then we'll feel significant. See, this is what we've done to show the world that we are great. This is the path we take. Now, here's the thing. We don't go about this path with impure motives in the beginning. Most of us don't. I'm not suggesting that we're like a bunch of people like plotting world domination, like how am I going to get all the power and the fame and the money because I will be an evil. No. We start with pure motives, right? The reason that we want the promotion at work oftentimes is because we want to provide for our family. That's an honorable, noble motive. You know, why do we want the wealth? Well, sometimes it's because we want to buy stuff for ourselves. I think a lot of times a lot of us think, man, we could do a lot of good with that wealth. I mean, the careers that we've chose, most of us, we choose a profession because at the end of the day, we want to help people. And we think that whatever career this is, that we could help some people with it. There's some noble and admirable motives. They're pure motives at the beginning of this path to greatness. But something happens. Something happens to each and every one of us when we go down this path to greatness, and Jesus is about to unpack it for us, okay? And when we read it, it's going to confront us, and it's going to challenge us and convict us, but we know it's true, okay? There's something that changes. Here's what he says in the very next verse. Verse 42 says, so Jesus calls them together. He sees the disciples are kind of like worried about this issue of greatness, and they're mad at each other, and they're jockeying for influence. They're envying the people who have authority. They want to be those people. So he calls them together and says, here's the deal. You know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. Now pause for a second. We got to dissect this. Because when you read the word rulers and officials, very few of us think of us. We often think of the people in high positions of authority, but think about rulers and officials in a different way. Someone who is seen as an authority with power and influence, which, by the way, is all of us to some degree. But he says, when you get in that position, and when you have power, and when you have influence, and when you have authority, here's what happens. In this world, you lord it over people, and you flaunt your authority over those underneath you. Now, y'all know this is true. We've seen this in so many other people's lives, haven't we? You've seen it in other people left and right. You ever had a friend that you knew them when they were starting out at the bottom, but now they're here? You know, they're successful and they've got a different kind of lifestyle and they're doing the thing, and all of a sudden they treat you a little bit different now that they live in a different economic stratosphere. If you're single, you ever been looked down on by a married person? Given the whole, like, what's wrong with you vibe? Why are you still single vibe? Yeah. You ever had a peer at work that got promoted and you didn't get promoted? And all of a sudden they start treating you a little different? And all of a sudden you notice they're starting to pull the ladder up a little bit and make it harder for you and all of their former peers to get promoted like they did. And you're like, whoa, what's happening? See, like, we see this in other people. We see this kind of arrogance and flaunting in celebrities and world leaders and movies. Like, we see it in other people. But the really uncomfortable truth is that this whole thing is not just true of other people, it's true of us. And here's how I know it. Okay, we're going to get real. You ready for some raw, real talk? It's going to get uncomfortable. I'm not going to make you stand up and confess your deepest, darkest. I'm not going to make you raise your hand. I'm just going to give you an example. And it's an example that you're going to be so, you will not want to admit that this is true, but it is so true of every single one of us. I want you to go back to the last time that you ran into somebody that you went to high school or college with, and you haven't seen him in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, okay? Maybe you run into him at the grocery store. Maybe you run into him at a social gathering. Maybe you went to your high school reunion. Maybe you got a random Facebook friend request from someone you haven't seen in years, right? Now, what happens inside of your heart when you come across this person? There is something that happens in a millisecond to every single one of us. There's a snap judgment. You remember how they used to be, and then you size them up a little bit. How'd they do? Well, they used to be super cute and super smart, and it seemed like they were poised for greatness, but they've let it go a little bit. They didn't make the best life choices. Like, ooh. Or opposite, you're like, man, they used to not be something, and now look at them. Like, wow, I never knew they had that in. That is amazing. And then what happens a millisecond later, again, this all happens so quick, and it's so subconscious and so sick and sadistic inside of us. But what happens in another millisecond is that first we size them up, then we compare ourselves to them. And it makes us feel some type of way, all right? Because you either feel really good about yourself or really bad about yourself. You see this person, if they've made a mess of their life, their relationship status isn't great, maybe they're not looking great anymore, maybe they don't have a great career, and all of a sudden you're like, man, I didn't do too bad. Or you feel the opposite way. And all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, I played way too many video games in college. I didn't go on that diet when I should have. I didn't stick to that. Oh, what have I done? They have really made something out of their lives, and I have not made anything out of my life. But it's so sick and so sick, but it's so true. Because here's the deal. Our path to greatness, our usual path to greatness, leads to comparison. When you're clamoring for the things of this world, when you're clamoring for the things that this world tells you will make you great and significant, that path always leads to a comparison game. And that's what's happening with the disciples here, and then Jesus' his example. The disciples are saying, hey, will you put us in the seats of honor and authority? Will you make us great? Because we see them and we want what they've got. We're envious of their positions. Like, we feel really bad about ourselves. We want to be like them. And Jesus says, well, if you get there and you get to that seat, then you're going to look down at people and you're going to flaunt it and you're going to lord it over people. You're going to compare yourself. Either way, our path to greatness puts us in a game of comparison. And friends, there is always someone to compare up to, and there's always someone to compare down to. There's always someone that's going to make you feel really good about yourself, and there's always someone that's going to make you feel really bad about yourself. And see, here's the reason that's such a problem for us. And it's such a nasty consequence of this path to greatness. Is that comparison is a life killer. Comparison is a life killer. It'll steal your joy. It'll rob you of any satisfaction that God intended for you to experience through the good gifts he's given you. When you're constantly comparing, you can't enjoy what you have. You're always looking at them and saying, man, I wish I had what they had. Or man, I'll never be as good of a mom as she is. Or man, I'll never be as ripped as he is. Or man, or the opposite, where you're like, man, I'm really glad I didn't end up like him. And that never leads to peace. And that's the real reason that this path to greatness is so devastating. Is that it never leads you to a place where at the end of the day, you lay your head down on your pillow and you're at peace. And that's not what Jesus wants for us. And so Jesus is not going to leave us there. He's going to offer us a different path. Now, I want to brace you for it because it is very different. It's very, very different. It is so countercultural. It is so opposite of what this world and everything we've observed in this world has taught us. But I believe it has the power to change your life. So let's go to it. Next verse. I love these first seven words. It says, but among you it will be different. Pause for a second. He says, I see you playing the comparison game. I see you doing this. But I'm telling you, for my followers, we're not going to get in that rat race. Among us, among people who follow me, we're going to do it different. And here's how it's going to go. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first among you must be the slave of everyone else. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Now, the concept of slavery and servanthood, when we hear that, we think of the evils of American slavery, and rightfully so. When in Jesus' time, slavery and servanthood looked a little different, but there are some very common threads. The most foundational common ones that they are at both instances, they're at the bottom of the ladder socially. No influence, and no one would perceive slaves and servants to be great, to be significant. Very, very common there. And now if you're a pragmatist in the room, you've got to be raging because this just does not make sense and this doesn't work. I think that's probably the thing that as I read it, just doesn't seem like it's going to work. I mean, Jesus. I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of servants, Jesus, but this isn't really how it works. Like, servants typically don't speak Jesus. See, Jesus, you understand that servants typically don't have any influence. Jesus, you understand that the path to greatness means you've got to be able to lead people. You've got to be able to make big change in society, to be a difference maker, right? And to do that, you've got to be able to lead people. You've got to be able to have a platform. You've got to be able to be seen and to be known. And Jesus, you understand that servants don't have a platform. Servants' whole job is to not be seen. They don't lead people. They serve people. Jesus, this is crazy. See, Jesus, this just doesn't work. Because if I do this, if I become like a servant, I'm putting myself, my career, my goals, and my ambitions at a major risk. Servants don't have their voice heard. Servants don't stand out as unique. Servants end up doing all the dirty work. They end up in very uncomfortable situations. They don't have their dreams fulfilled. Servants get overlooked for promotions. Servants don't get to fulfill their potential. Servants probably had a lot more under the hood that they could have offered the world, but no one will ever know because they aren't recognized. They aren't lifted up. They have no platform. They're forgotten. They're always at the mercy of others. Servants aren't even noticed, Jesus. And I hear you, and I'm with you. I think the same thing. It doesn't make sense. But here's the problem. Jesus makes it really, really hard to argue with him. Makes it really hard to argue with him on this one. Because his argument for why this way of life works, his argument for this path to greatness, is not a principle or a theory. His argument for it is a person. He says, for even the Son of Man. Jesus says, even me. Even the goat, even the greatest of all time, came not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus says, if you want to talk about greatness, let me show you how it's done. Look to me. He says, even the Son of Man, the one who has more birthright than anyone in this world, he's the very Son of God. The one who has the limitless power and resources at his disposal. He created the world and everything in it. He's proven time and time again that the laws of the universe do not apply to him. He could do whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted it. He was the very definition of greatness, power, fame, prestige, influence, resources, fame, and wealth. Yet, he was born into a barn, in a nobody town, to a nobody family, willingly entered this world in complete poverty. He gave up all of his rights and privileges. He's a man without a home throughout his ministry, a nomad going from town to town, never using his status as the Son of God for any perks, never lorded his power and authority over anyone. And did you know that Jesus' voice wasn't always heard? Did you know that he actually went to his death on the cross fairly silent? Like a sheep led to the slaughter, is what the scripture tells us. Never defending himself. Do you know that Jesus didn't stand out as unique in his life? He had a common Jewish name, looked like a common Jewish man, and he died a common death. See, crucifixion, we see the cross and we automatically think of Jesus. But that wouldn't have been the case when Jesus died. Hundreds of people were crucified every week. It was a very common way to execute criminals. In fact, Jesus was crucified between two common criminals. They treated him as a complete nobody to the very end. Did you know that Jesus left a ton of potential on the table? As a type A leader, we're always thinking, let's fulfill our purpose. Let's not leave anything on the table. Jesus actually left a lot on the table. Could have fixed the whole world and everything in it with a snap of a finger. But he didn't. Could have healed more people than he did. But he just humbly submitted to his Father's plan and did what he was supposed to do, did what he was told to do. And did you know that he was forgotten? Hard to imagine because we're talking about him 2,000 years later, but his closest followers abandoned him when he died, and many of his followers just forgot about him because they assumed that his death was the end of him. See, Jesus was poised and set up to follow the path of greatness that you and I follow. I mean, he could have had it all. He could have been the greatest world leader we've ever known. All the power, all the fame, all the wealth, all the wisdom, all the skills, all the intelligence. He could have had it all. And instead, he laid it all down. In the service of others, he laid down everything, even his own life, for you and for me. And that's why he's the greatest. That's why we're still talking about him 2,000 years later. Now, we're going to take the next 4 weeks and we're going to deep dive into this whole concept of servant leadership and what does it mean to make a difference with your life. So we're gonna deep dive into how this applies to your life and how to live this out. But there's a foundational question that's still lurking out there for all the logical thinkers in the room and all the pragmatists. And that question is how. Like, how is it even possible to begin to live a life like that? Because I mean, let's get real. Let's cut through and get to like bare bones reality here. I know you. You know me. We are some selfish people. Okay. When my kids ask me for a bite of my ice cream, the first thing I think in my head is, "No, booger face, go get your own ice cream." You got bowls and spoons. You got plenty of things. Go get off my. Now I give them ice cream because I'm not a horrible person. But our snap reality, our default is selfish. Whereas Jesus is suggesting that the way to be great is to be selfless. And so how could we even get to a place where our heart is in a disposition to be like that? Like, how is that even possible? It just seems so idealistic. It seems so far out of reach. It seems impossible. A couple weeks ago, I was on the West Coast, and I was spending some time with a lead pastor out there. And I felt like it was an honor. I was there with some other pastors and just learning from this lead pastor, very famous lead pastor on the West Coast. And he's written many books that have impacted the church worldwide. And he spoke at conferences. His church reaches tens of thousands of people every week. And I mean, honestly, like, I felt like I was sitting with greatness. I'm by the world's definition and by my definition, it was like, this guy is great. He has achieved all the marks of greatness. And so I felt like I was sitting down with a legend. But I tell you, my experience with him was very different than what I thought it would be. See, as I sat down with him and we all started talking to him, asking him questions, there were some things I noticed about him that were just very, very different. So, like, for instance, he never seemed to be that excited about or impressed by his own achievements. He was like, yeah, I've written some books, whatever. Like, oh yeah, church has grown, okay. And in fact, he started referencing churches that he was trying to learn from, that he was really curious about, and he's like interviewing leaders of churches that are way smaller than his. He's like, man, I love what they're doing, that's really interesting. And I'm like, huh, that's weird, okay. He just seemed very uninterested in the things that our world has defined as great and significant. Very uninterested in it. But I also noticed that he spends his time in weird ways. Like, for instance, one of the things I found out about him is that he feels like one of his life callings is to influence and help pastors. But he doesn't discern, like, pastors that are more worthy of his time versus those who are not. So, like, if anyone calls or emails him and says, hey, I need some help with a problem, he schedules a 30-minute phone call with them, and it doesn't matter if you're a pastor of a church of 30 or a pastor of a church of 30,000. He's going to give you the same 30 minutes. He's just very uninterested in what the world defines as significant. And I just thought that was so weird. But I think the thing that struck me the most about him was this level of peace that he seemed to have. He just seemed so comfortable with who he was. He knew his weaknesses. He wasn't pretending. He shared a lot of his weaknesses with us. But he just seemed so at peace. I think the best way to put it is, it didn't seem like he was running the same rat race that the rest of us are running. It didn't seem like he was caught up in all, like, the, man, I got to, like, one-up people. I got to climb the ladder. I got to, like, prove myself. I got to make sure that I'm significant. He was just at a real resting pace and peace. And he actually verbalized it at one point, because we asked him, like, man, there's just something different about you. Like, what is it? What's your vibe? Like, how are you like you are? He was like, oh, I can tell you that, yeah. And I'll never forget his words. He said, guys, I feel like I start out on third base compared to most people. I feel like I start out with an advantage, because I've just never had this, like, deep desire to achieve more than the next person. I've never had this, like, deep desire to prove myself to be more significant or greater than someone else. I've just never had the desire to climb the ladder. I've never had the desire to do any of that stuff. I just kind of, like, went to work every day, and I do the best I can with what I've got, and I don't worry about who thinks what about me. I'm not worried about the approval of people. He said, I just go to work. I do the best I can under my current circumstances, and then I go home, and I take a nap. And I was like, that sounds really nice. Sounds beautiful. Because honestly, that's not me. I mean, just getting raw with you, that's not my reality. Sometimes it is. But most oftentimes, I find myself getting worried about what other people think about me. Most oftentimes, I get myself wrapped up in, you know, am I significant enough? Am I leaving anything on the table? Am I maximizing my impact? I mean, truthfully, most of the time, what I'm worried about, it's like, am I enough? Like, at the end of my life, will I have, like, done enough? Am I enough as a person? And so I'm sitting here looking at this guy, and he's just at peace with himself. And I'm like, man, I wish I could have that. That looks incredible. And so we asked him, like, how'd you get there? Like, how did you get an advantage? How did you start out on third base? And I'll never forget his response. He said, I started out on third base with an advantage over everyone because of my mother and father. So my mom and dad were my heroes, still are my heroes. So they're dead and they're gone, but they are the greatest people I've ever known. And my mom and my dad loved me with an unconditional love. Said they never put work over me. They were always at every sporting event, but they never treated me different based on my performance. They always encouraged me to do good in school, but they never held it over me that I had to get good grades. It was like, they were just always there loving me and supporting me and telling me that I'm valuable and that I'm significant. And they were just the best parents you could ever imagine. He said, that's why I start out on third base with an advantage. Because I just know at the end of the day that regardless of the output of my career, regardless of the output of my life, I'm going to go home at the end of the day to a mom and a dad who think I am great and I am significant and I am loved no matter what I do. And man, when he said that, I couldn't help but think of Jesus. Because see, Jesus, like, how was Jesus able to lay down his all the greatness that the world says he should have chased? How was Jesus able to lay that down and sacrifice for others and be a servant of others? See, I was reminded of Jesus' baptism specifically. And I want to read it to you real quick. It's from Matthew chapter 3. But I want you to remember that Jesus' baptism was the signal to, like, begin his ministry. So he hadn't actually done anything yet. He had not achieved anything yet. He had no followers. He had no one that was like spreading the word about Jesus preaching. He hadn't healed anybody. He hadn't done anything. He had accomplished nothing that the world would say would make him significant. But I want you to look at what happens at his baptism. Matthew chapter 3. It says, after his baptism, as Jesus came up out of the water, the heavens were opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and settling on him. And here it is. And a voice from heaven said, this is my dearly loved Son, who brings me great joy. This is my dearly loved Son who brings me great joy. Before he's done anything, he's not accomplished anything yet. But yet the Father looks to him and says, this is my dearly loved Son. He brings me great joy. One translation says, in him I am well pleased. I'm pleased with him and he hasn't done anything yet. You see, Jesus was able to enjoy the love, the unconditional love of his heavenly Father. And that's what enabled him to do what he did, to live the life that he led. See, Jesus wasn't looking to the things that the world tells us make us significant. Jesus knew he was significant because his heavenly Father loved him. That's what made him great. That's what made him valuable. And maybe that's the best question that you can ask yourself and in your groups this week. To really drive this home and really work through this is simply this question. What makes you valuable? What makes you valuable? What makes you significant? What makes you worth it? Because you need to know, somebody needs to know in this room at every campus, that you can start out on third base too. You can start out with an advantage. Regardless of how your parents raised you, regardless of how your earthly father treated you, because you need to know that you are valuable to God. God, your heavenly Father, knit you together in your mother's womb, and he decided long before you ever did anything, that you were worth it. That you were great in his eyes. That you were valuable. You need to know that God's crazy about you. You need to know that he's wild about you. He sees you and he sees greatness. He sees the thing he created. You know, when I put my kids to bed every night, I've got a 6-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. I say the same thing to them every single night. It's like if I do one good thing as a parent, I'm trying to do this thing over and over and over. I say the same things to him every single night. I tuck him in, and I look him in the eye, and I say, no matter what happens, I will always love you, and there's nothing you can ever do to make me stop loving you. I say it to him every night, and the reason I say it to him is I want them to know deep down in their heart, I want them to have heard it in their head a million times, I want them to know beyond a shadow of a doubt how their heavenly Father feels about them by way of how their earthly Father treats them. And I'm hoping and praying that that makes a difference in their life and that they're able to start out on third base, but you need to know that that's how God feels about you. That no matter what happens, he's always going to love you. And there's nothing you can ever do to make him stop loving you. I don't care how bad it's been. I don't care what you did 10 years ago. I don't care what you did last night. I don't care what deep, dark secret you're hiding. It doesn't change God's affection and love for you. He's crazy about you. And did you know that he's actually hot after you right now? Jesus told us at one point that his love, he likened it to a shepherd that has 100 sheep. And then one of them wanders away and gets lost. And he says, guess what? If you were that one, I love you so much, I'd leave the 99 and come find you. That's how much I love you. And you see, if you can start there, if you can build your life on the foundation of God's wild love for you, then you poise yourself, you position yourself for true greatness. Because God's love frees us up to lay everything down. God's love will free you up to lay it all down. Because if God's love is where you're finding your significance and your value and your worth, you know that at the end of the day, nothing can take that away from you. You could lose the power, the fame, the wealth, the beauty. Guess what? You're going to lose it all one day anyways. If you can stop looking there for your greatness and just know that God has declared you to be great in his sight, he loves you. And you are lovely because he loves you. You start there, you can make a difference with your life. You can be great. And so I want to pray that God would ground our church in that love as we start this series off. And I think in doing so, it'll open our hearts up for what he wants to do. So let me pray that for us right now. Father, we love you, but we love you only because you first loved us. And so we just thank you for that. God, I pray for anybody in the room right now that's just wrestling with whether or not this is true, that you'd show them in these next moments that it is, that you are the way, the truth, and the life. God, you didn't just say that you loved us, but you proved it when you sent your son Jesus to stretch out his arms and die on a cross for us. It was a concrete statement of your love for us. So God, I pray for our church that you would just settle our foundation on you, that you'd help us to fight against the cultural current that pushes us to look to the things of this world for greatness, that pushes us to clamor for power and fame and wealth and influence and leadership, to hang our hat on those things. But no, God, at the end of the day, we want to rest in you and rest in your love. So God, I pray that you would help us to do that as we move forward. And it's in Jesus' name the church prays together. Amen.